Okay, let's unpack this. What we have here is a deep dive into an extraordinary document, a memoir that chronicles one of the most dramatic, gut-wrenching reversals of fortune in modern history.
Exactly. We are looking at Malika Ufkir's Stolen Lives, 20 years in a desert jail. It's a book that really forces you to confront the brutal paradox of supreme privilege being instantly annihilated by political violence in an authoritarian state.
Right. Our subject, Malika Ufkir, born in 1953, she eventually becomes an author, a human rights advocate. But the core of her story and this memoir from 99, it's that unbelievable transition.
Yeah, from Moroccan socialite, even a royal ward, to political prisoner.
And it's more than just her personal story, isn't it? You mentioned it's a historical document.
Oh, absolutely. It's vital. It sheds light on Morocco's years of lead, a really dark time. Intense state violence, repression, disappearances, all under King Hassan II.
So Malika's account sort of pulls back the curtain on how that system worked.
Right.
Especially the revenge aspect.
Precisely. And the hook for you listening is just the contrast. She's informally adopted by King Mohammed V, raised like a princess in the palace, pampered, you know.
Total opulence.
And then, boom, that life is just violently ripped away, replaced by 2 decades, 20 years in these lightless dungeons in the Sahara Desert.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So our mission here is to trace that transformation, understand how she and her family fought back against just complete oblivion,
yeah,
to reclaim who they were.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Her formative years, they're defined by this deep split, really.
A duality, you said.
Yeah. Her biological father was General Mohammed Ufkir, a major figure, minister of the interior, head of the secret police, King Hassan II's most trusted man, and also his most feared.
Wow. Heavy hitter.
Definitely. But then Malika, at just 5 years old, is taken away from her family, sent to live in the royal palace. Permanently.
Like a companion for the princess, right? Lal Amina.
Exactly. It was partly a political gesture, partly social. But the effect on Malika was huge. It basically fractured her sense of self from a very young age.
So she's living this life of total luxury. Designer clothes, servants.
Oh, the works. Inside the royal bubble. But at the same time, the book talks about this profound loneliness. Her identity wasn't really hers. It all depended on the king's mood, his favor.
And her real family. Her parents, siblings.
She only saw them on these very formal, supervised visits. It sounds incredibly isolating, beautiful on the outside maybe, but kind of hollow.
Okay, so then she gets a bit older. King Hassan II is now on the throne. Has life changed for her?
It does a bit. She gets more freedom, relatively speaking, a modern French-style education. And by the late 60s, early 70s, she's become this... well, this jet-setting socialite.
Like rebellious, miniskirts, dating.
Yeah, all of that. It was a kind of quiet rebellion, you could say, against the conservative court. But she was still very much tied to the monarchy, watched constantly. Still a satellite.
Hmm. And how aware was she, do we think, of what her father actually did? His methods, the political reality?
That's a key point. The book suggests she lived in a state of, well, maybe willful ignorance, protected by privilege, insulated from the nasty stuff, the brutal methods her father used.
So she's enjoying this life, unaware it's all built on something quite dark.
Pretty much. Living on borrowed time, really. The foundation, her father's power, the king's favor, was about to crumble spectacularly.
Which brings us to the cataclysm. August 16th, 1972, she was 19.
Just 19. General Ufkir attempts this coup, tries to assassinate King Hassan II, a fighter jet attack on the king's plane.
And it failed.
Failed completely. And General Ufkir was dead that very night.
Officially a suicide.
That was the official story. The family always maintained he was executed. But either way, the name Ufkir instantly became poison. Treason.
And the king's revenge wasn't just against the general.
No, no. That's the chilling part about absolute power. It was total. He took the entire family. Malika, her mother Fatima, 5 younger siblings. The youngest was only 3.
3 years old.
Yeah. First, house arrest. Then in 74, they were driven south, deep into the desert, to these secret prisons, Brigidid, Agdid, places designed to make people disappear.
So that pampered socialite we talked about,
yeah,
she had to change overnight.
Instantly. The memoir describes her becoming the family's protector, the de facto matriarch. Her mother was often incapacitated by depression, understandably.
What a burden for a young woman.
Incredible. They were in total isolation, starving, often in complete darkness for years. She was fighting off scorpions, disease, but mostly fighting off despair for the little ones.
And her main weapon was storytelling. Memory.
Exactly. She used memories of her old life, describing films she'd seen, lavish meals, travel, anything to keep their minds alive, to remind them there was an outside world that light existed.
The ghost train story.
Ah, yes. That's such a powerful example. Locked in pitch blackness, she'd take the children on these elaborate imaginary train journeys, describing landscapes, colors, things they hadn't seen in years.
It wasn't just escapism then.
Not at all. It was defiance. Imposing structure, beauty, humanity onto this inhuman situation. It was a way to fight back mentally.
So that old worldview, the entitlement, the focus on pleasure, it must have just evaporated.
Completely stripped away. Her philosophy became incredibly primal, basic. Just three pillars, really.
Okay, what were they?
First, survival. Just taking life one breath at a time. The goal wasn't happiness or success. It was simply seeing the next sunrise. Literally.
One second.
Family, the very thing she was sort of distanced from as a child, it became everything. Her absolute center, her religion, she calls it, the reason to keep going.
That's a powerful shift. From loneliness in a palace to finding connection in a dungeon.
Right. It was their only real collaboration. And the third pillar.
Imagination.
Imagination as resistance. The mind was the only place they were free, so she used it actively. Refusing to let the prison walls confine her spirit. It wasn't about escaping reality, but enduring it.
That act of resistance. Celebrating birthdays, creating routines, even in hell.
That's what kept them from breaking. And their physical will was just as strong. In 1987, after 15 years.
The escape attempt.
Yes. Malika and three siblings, they spent months digging a tunnel with a spoon, a stick. Incredible. And they got out. Briefly.
Just the act itself must have been huge psychologically.
Absolutely. It shattered that feeling of helplessness, proved they still had agency. Even though they were caught quickly, put in even harsher conditions, that act changed things.
How so?
Well, word got out, their story started circulating, breaking that total silence the regime relied on.
And that combined with a later hunger strike in 1991.
Right. The hunger strike was desperate, but it worked. It finally brought international pressure. Amnesty International, French media. People started asking questions.
So the king couldn't just pretend they didn't exist anymore.
Exactly. It led to their conditional release. And then finally, in 1996, 20 years after they disappeared, they were allowed to leave Morocco.
20 years. And writing Stolen Lives was the final step.
The final act of reclamation, yes. Bearing witness, telling her story, their story, in her own words, reclaiming the narrative.
Okay, let's pinpoint three key turning points in this whole saga. The first has to be that initial move to the palace, right? The royal adoption at age 5.
Definitely. That's the foundation. It split her identity, made her dependent on the court, and ironically set her up for the fall. The institution that raised her became the one that destroyed her.
Without that, the story might have been entirely different.
Okay.
Turning point two.
Has to be the coup attempt and her father's death in 1972. That moment just cleaved her life in two instantly.
From princess to pariah.
Overnight. The end of innocence, the beginning of this brutal education and political revenge.
And the third, you talked about agency.
The escape attempt from Birajay did in 1987, even though it failed in the short term.
Why was that so transformative?
Because it was their action. It proved they weren't broken. Psychologically, that's immense, and practically, it cracked the wall of silence. It forced their existence back into the light, eventually leading to freedom.
Let's talk about the human lessons here. That anecdote about dividing the food, the single chickpea, it's just devastating.
It really is. It captures the extremity of their suffering, but also their incredible dignity.
Explain that ritual again.
In the worst times, their ration might be just a handful of chickpeas for the entire family, 7 people. And they would meticulously, carefully divide that tiny amount into 7 absolutely equal portions.
Why? When you're starving?
Because it wasn't just about food. It was about fairness, solidarity, maintaining their humanity, refusing to become animals fighting over scraps, which is what the prison system wanted. It was a profound act of resistance. That bond, that shared ritual kept them human.
But there's a difficult layer here, too, isn't there?
Yeah.
The legacy of her father, General Ofkir.
Yes, we have to acknowledge that complexity. Malika and her siblings were innocent victims, endured unimaginable injustice, no question. But General Ofkir himself was a key figure in that same repressive system. He was the architect of the violence that eventually consumed his own family, responsible for disappearances, like the famous case of Mehdi Ben Barka.
So the memoir focuses on the family as victims.
Which is completely understandable from a daughter's perspective. She's telling her truth, their suffering. But as readers, we see that irony, that moral complexity. Their earlier privilege was, in part, built on the suffering Ufkir inflicted on others.
It's a stark reminder of how these systems can turn on anyone, even their creators.
Exactly. But the overriding lesson from Malika herself is about resilience. And that resilience isn't something you just have. It's something you build, day by day, consciously, through ritual, through hope, even when it seems illogical.
Okay, let's wrap this up with three final takeaways. First, an emotional insight.
She went into that darkness a spoiled, somewhat superficial young woman defined by external things. She came out a leader, a storyteller, someone who lost everything on the outside but discovered this deep core strength inside through protecting her family, through sheer endurance.
Powerful. Now, an intellectual insight.
Stolen Lives is devastating because it rips away that glamorous mask of monarchy. It shows you the terrifying reality of absolute power. Political revenge isn't abstract. It's cold. It's dark. It's the hunger in a child's belly. You feel it.
And finally, a universal insight. What's the lesson for all of us?
That the ultimate freedom, the one thing nobody can ever truly take away, is the freedom of your own mind. Imagination isn't just daydreaming. It's a tool. A light you switch on inside yourself when every other light has gone out is how you endure the unbearable.
What stands out to me is that reminder that our mind is the ultimate sanctuary. When everything is taken away, the ability to control your narrative and your thoughts is the final act of defiance.
Indeed. Her story makes us appreciate that freedom is not just an abstract concept, but something visceral. The ability to see the sky, choose your food, or speak to a loved one. The true, lasting victory is that she reclaimed her voice to tell the world what was truly happening behind those desert walls.